You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon. My name is Maryam Alahi, and I direct the International Women's Program here at the Open Society Foundations. And I would like to welcome you all to this event this afternoon, which is focused on the PBS miniseries Women, War, and Peace. We're delighted to have with us Pamela, Abby, and Ginny, and Charlotte, who will lead the discussion about the focus of the miniseries, which is basically questioning gender roles in the context of conflict, post-conflict, and the consequences of conflict on women, and women as leaders within communities that are in conflict. It was very thrilling when about 3 years ago, we initially started the conversation when this was just a brainchild, and as we've had further conversations, and it's now come to fruition to look at the road that's been traveled and how exciting it is, where it's come and where it's actually heading. And I think it's particularly fortuitous and exciting that this year's Nobel Prize was focused on women peacemakers and the role that women play in this very difficult context of conflict in terms of turning the tide around. So hopefully with that kind of a momentum and with the mini-series now at a place where it's actually doing its outreach in communities, in schools, et cetera, we're gonna be changing minds and views and policies on this very important issue. The way that we're gonna proceed is we will have a 16-minute clip that shows different pieces of the miniseries. As some of you, I hope all of you have seen the whole miniseries, but it's a 5-part miniseries. So those of you who haven't seen it, I hope that your appetite will be whetted by what you see, and you can definitely see it online. You can stream online at the website and see it. After that, Charlotte Bunch, who is the founding director of the Center for Women's Leadership at Rutgers and a senior scholar currently there, will lead the discussion with our panelists, and we very much look forward to an inspiring conversation with all of you. Again, I welcome you here, and Lisa, if we could start the DVD. Thank you.
Well, I hope many of you have seen some, if not all, of the 5 parts of this. I want to call it a maxi series. There's nothing mini about this series. It's really an amazing production of 5, each one which could be watched and used for hours by itself. And I think that's part of what's really important to know, is that each of the parts of this series really stands alone as a lesson in thinking about women, war, and peace, and conflict, and also issues of what is justice, what is gender justice in particular, but also what is justice, what is transitional justice, how race and class interface with the issues of women and gender. I've used at least 2 of them in the classroom already, and they're really fabulous for all these kinds of political discussions. So I just want to start by, again, thanking Abby and Ginny and Pamela for such an amazing series. For those of us who've watched women over the last 2 decades, really struggling so hard to be seen and heard, this is really a landmark in the process of getting those voices out there. And I think also in particular, not just as victims, but as the agents and the voices of change. And that's one of the things I want to applaud this series for doing, which is in each one of these, you hear from women as the actors, and not only the victimization, which isn't, we don't shy away from, you don't shy away from, but that isn't what you leave with. You leave with the voices of women and what they are doing for change. And I think it's just an amazing series. So I want to just start with saying that and thanking you all again. And then I think we want to focus most on kind of what next and where the series goes, but particularly for those who haven't heard, let's just take a couple of minutes with each of you saying something about why you did it. You know, what motivated you to get involved in this project, and what were your hopes? And then I'd like to turn the question to sort of, now that it's out there in the world, where we take it from here. So you want to start, Abby, or Jenny?
Do you want to start, Pam?
Or Pamela? I'm sorry, I went the wrong way. Pamela.
Well, sure. I came to the series after 8 years. Thank you for those really nice words, Charlotte, and thank you for having us, Maryam. We're really delighted to be here.
I should have introduced you. Everyone should have the list. This is Pamela. Sorry,
and
Hogan.
I should say that one of our first conversations was with Maryam, and it was thrilling, without even knowing if we would ever become a grantee, to find a kindred spirit and someone who felt that what we were thinking about doing was important. And she's been a wonderful supporter, and OSI has been through the whole series. So thank you so much. We're thrilled to be here. I came to the series after 8 years with Wide Angle, which is a PBS global series. It was on every week during the summer for 8 or 9 years, I guess. And it was a great experience, very human stories, telling global issues through human voices. But I did come to feel after a few years, I said to the executive producer, I was the series producer at the time, maybe we should call it Narrow Angle, because it seemed as though, particularly with stories of conflict, but so often the actors in the stories were the men. And, there were sort of political stories about political actors, and I just knew there were a lot of voices that were not coming into the radar. And so we actually just began commissioning some stories that we knew were out there about women, and they were wonderfully received. We felt that it was quite an underreported part of the world. And when we started developing a story about women in Rwanda, discovered that they were really leading the country forward after 10 years after the genocide, I knew Ginny's incredible body of work in making films about women, and we asked Ginny to direct it and came out with a beautiful film called Ladies First, about women really leading Rwanda, not just, 30% in the parliament, but from the ground up, rebuilding through spiritual healing and being entrepreneurs and being the more trusted members of the country after this horrible genocide where so many of the men had been implicated. Not to say that some women were not genocidaires, but by and large, it was the men that were not trusted. So that's where I came from, and we started having a discussion, and they can tell the other part of it.
I think both Abby and I came out of it from making Pray the Devil Back to Hell. And we had made the film, which is about Liberia and what the women in Liberia did to bring an end to the war. And I think when I first got to Liberia, I thought, if Charles Taylor is the bad guy, that must mean that the rebels are the good guys. And I quickly learned that there were no good guys in the fight, and that it was a totally different way of looking at war than I had ever thought, that they were basically both thugs, and that the civilians were in the middle, and that this was a story of what women who had been completely victimized, and the press had only reported on the victimization of the women, but that they had been incredibly important agents in bringing an end to the war. And I started to realize that this was happening all over the world. And so, I think then, and then Pam and I started the discussion just as Abby and I were finishing Pray the Devil Back to Hell.
And I came to Pray the Devil Back to Hell because, let me back up and add my thanks to OSI and particularly to Maryam Elahi. It takes an enormous amount of vision to be as supportive as Maryam was, to know from the beginning, just from a verbal description of something that's kind of megalomaniac and crazy, that you want to support it. And Maryam really did step up for us in a way that was incredible. So I just want to add my thanks. I went to Liberia in 2006, right after President Sirleaf was inaugurated, with a group of women who wanted to just be supportive of Sirleaf's presidency there. And I had never made a film and kind of didn't want to make a film, wasn't really thinking in those terms. But while I was there, I kind of heard this story about what the women did in Liberia. And it was just kind of a story that I happened to hear. Just, if it had been in the road, I would have tripped over it. And I came home, sort of haunted by the idea that this would make a really great film, but also really annoyed, really, really, really annoyed. And to go backwards just a little bit, many years ago when I was writing my PhD dissertation at Columbia, it was on war novels. And it always struck me, writing about war novels, just how few women there were in those landscapes. Even though sometimes the language would imply women, rape and pillage, house to house combat, you'd you'd know that there had to have been women in there somewhere, and yet persistently they were kind of written out of these landscapes. And I felt like I was finding myself in the midst of a very real world example of the very same thing, which is to presume that war is this entirely masculine affair and that it has nothing to do with women or that women have nothing to do with it. And here were these women who really made themselves the center of it, and we had just simply looked the other way and were permitting ourselves to forget it. And so that's why we started Pray the Devil Back to Hell. And you know, a lot of the time in Q&As after screenings, people would say, why did this happen in Liberia? Why doesn't this happen in other places? And it drove me nuts, because it happens in other places all the time, and it's been happening for millennia, and we still just simply can't get ourselves to see the world through a woman's eyes. And that's really what it comes down to, is the war narrative, whether it's fiction or fact, tends to just give the camera to John Wayne, and then off you go. And that's what you see. You see the war through John Wayne's eyes. And this was an attempt to say, no, wait, actually, there's value in seeing it through a woman's eyes. And in fact, the whole pursuit kind of shifts. And that was kind of the heart of the project, was to recast women into this landscape that they had persistently been written out of for centuries.
Well, I think that it's a great success in doing that. And now I'm going to ask you to talk about kind of what next, and preface that by saying, when I was showing this with my students and having a discussion, they also said, why didn't we know these things before? How could we not know that, you know, women did this in Bosnia 20 years ago, and that I talked about the Japanese comfort women case and the women who from World War II have been struggling for justice, and the fact that this has been, you know, so many years. So how, and then the question came up, okay, so now we finally begin to have this documentation. Where do we take this next? So
where do we take this from here?
Let's go with that, and then I'll open the floor to questions from everybody.
So the plan always was to have kind of unrolling process of the films, and that broadcast would be sort of the beginning of a long process with them. And broadcast was very important. It was very important to get it into living rooms, you know, because you needed to take this and not have it be in a classroom and not have it be in some special other place, but to really take it right to people's hearts. And that's a hard thing to do in a very noisy marketplace in the United States, where Kim Kardashian is just one little click away. And we don't want to see the world through her eyes. It's not good. And so we worked really hard. We started in January on doing outreach for this broadcast, starting in October through November 8th. And we did a lot of work with NGOs and civil society organizations, from the big national obvious ones like the YWCA and the Girl Scouts, down to tiny little community-based organizations here in New York City, Correctional Association, Family Health Project. There are all kinds of small NGO relationships and women's organizations around the country that we tried to mobilize around the broadcast. We used a lot of social networking. We used a lot of internet. And so just to give you a sense of what we've already done in terms of moving people, we had a cumulative number of about 12.5 million viewers. to put that into, that's for all five episodes, to put that into perspective for you, that's about twice as many viewers as might on average come to a POV or an independent lens. This is without a penny for advertising, so that was all through networking, all through online, all through relationships, all through shoe leather and phone calls and appearances. I made 48 appearances, I just found out yesterday, just in the month of October. I'm trying to figure out that mathematically. I'm not really sure how I did that. So that was hard work, and I'm really proud. It paid off incredibly. We also saw a really, really vibrant online conversation really take off. Our likes on Facebook went from 5,000 to 38,000 within the 5 weeks of broadcast. There was a huge Twitter conversation that continued and continues to continue in the weeks after broadcast, and there's really an active, lively group of people who really want to talk about these issues. So first, mission accomplished. We really did get this conversation out in the United States, and now the second piece of that is to sell it into developed world broadcasting systems and hopefully get the same kind of conversation going there. But there was always a sense that you need to reach various audiences, and you reach various audiences in different ways. There's a second audience that's really important, which is people who influence, people who make policy, people who sit in cigar-filled rooms and decide stuff. And those are people that can be, you have to penetrate, you know, the rooms and find a way to get to them, but once you've gotten to them, they are actually very influenceable with film. Film is the single most effective, I think, way of getting to policymakers. And so we've been working on that vigorously, and we're going to continue working on that. Any of you in this room who can help us on these kinds of screenings, we'd love to hear from you. But we've had three screenings on Capitol Hill already. We're organizing a screening in the Pentagon. I'm hoping to be in Davos, and the U.S. Navy, as a result of one of these screenings, has asked us to create training material for their Navy simulators on specifically on the role of women in conflict zones for men who are being deployed into, men and women who are being deployed into peacekeeping operations. So there's, my favorite influencer screening was for the entire class of 2013 at West Point. So there are all kinds of opportunities to work with people in uniform, work with people in the political sphere, work with the Norwegian mediators, for instance, and people in the UN and the Department of Peacekeeping Operations and so forth. And we're going to keep working hard on pushing those influencer screenings. And that's, you know, that's a project that will be over the next couple of years. And then the third audience, and the audience that is really close to my heart, actually there's four audiences, sorry. The third audience is students, and we have a very, WNET has a terrific, amazing education department that reaches into, I think, 78% of American public schools. It has a gathering of over 10,000 teachers from around the country every year, and we've been at it for the last 2 years. We'll be there again for a third year, and so we're really pushing on educational as well. So, okay, so the fourth audience and my favorite audience is grassroots community-based organizations that work with women, not only in post-conflict zones and in pre-conflict zones and in mid-conflict zones, but also here domestically in the United States. And to give you an example, we really reached a lot of people with Pray the Devil Back to Hell. There were almost 1,000 community screenings around the country and also in 60 countries around the world. Domestically, there was a group called the Mothers in Charge in Philadelphia. They're my total favorite because after they saw Pray the Devil Back to Hell, they went out and started picketing a gun shop that was in their area. These were women from all classes and races who'd lost sons and daughters to gun violence, and they were able to get this gun shop moved out of city limits, which is really incredible. And then, you know, we had a whole ton of screenings internationally for women's groups that were incredibly in the midst of conflict or looking at conflict bearing down on them in Tbilisi, Georgia, 6 months before the conflict with Russia there. The women created a position statement, and they took this position statement, this is in the hour after they saw Pray the Devil Back to Hell, and they took the position statement up into Ossetia and Abkhazia to work with women across the line. So that's the process that we're just getting started on now. And I'm just back, I'm just back from Oslo, where I got to watch Lema get the Nobel Peace Prize, which was a little awesome. but before that, I was in Sri Lanka, where we were able to go up into the north and talk to women from the north who, you know, basically said to me in no uncertain terms, we'll do anything to make sure war doesn't happen again in this country. And, you know, how do we talk about that? And so basically what we do in these international distribution sort of fact-finding missions is I just talk about the films and I talk about the effect that they've had, and I talk about them as basically I'm selling them as tools. They are a little Tahrir squares in a box, each of these films. So what we're planning to do is create what we call a screening series in a box. And it's going to come with discussion guides that are focused on organizing and activism and being a viable political actor in the public sphere. Because, you know, women very often, especially in highly patriarchal societies, need an invitation. But once they have the invitation, you can't send them home again, which is what we're seeing in Egypt, and we're seeing it in Syria and Libya and so forth. And so this is their little engraved invitation. And theoretically, you know, for instance, we're working with the worldwide YWCA. They have 22,000 affiliate organizations in 120 countries. And we're going to get it as broadly as we can to their member organizations. And so theoretically, once a month, for 5 months. These women come together, they see a film, and then they talk about what does this film trigger in you in terms of thinking about organizing in your own context. And hopefully what we'll do is, not in every case, but in many cases, create indigenous, sustainable political movements that rise up from within community-based organizations and women who are really at the grassroots level, because those are really the kinds of changes that are going to build a different kind of political reality around the world. So we're hoping to raise enough money to do about 5,000 of these screening series in a box. We need to dub, we need to translate, we need to create the discussion guides, we need to build the relationships, and building relationships involves sometimes a phone call or emails, but sometimes it involves getting on an airplane and going to a place and really meeting people and making sure they understand what we think we have in this box and what we think we can do. So when I left Sri Lanka, the women at the YWCA were talking about getting the films into all of the schools and universities across the country and working with women's groups across the north and getting the films into women's organizations across the north. So that feels to me like something that could really, you know, have a substantial impact on the reconciliation process and the political processes going forward in that country. So country by country and context by context in a way that's hopefully respectful and appropriate to the people who are living through those conflicts, we're going to try and activate the sort of latent political powers of women and women's groups, particularly at the community-based level.
Great, thank you. Pamela, do you want to add to that anything?
I couldn't possibly.
Are you kidding?
No, I think she's already.
It was pretty comprehensive, and I would be interested in also how the women's groups that have been working on these issues are picking up on this and using it, because I think it does enable many women who've been doing this and have been invisible to get themselves seen by the policymakers and those who are in, because I agree with you that it has been happening almost everywhere, but the people in charge haven't seen it.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the key things.
Absolutely. And we had, Crown Prince Haakon of Norway, who said to us, I've always understood 1325, many of you may know, is a UN Security Council resolution that's 11 years old now, that requires that women be involved at all levels as actors and agents and not just as victims in peace building and post-conflict reconstruction. It's never really been funded. It's never really been tried. And the Crown Prince of Norway said to us after he saw Pray the Devil Back to Hell, gosh, I always knew 1325 was important. I just couldn't picture it until then. And that's really the power of films like these, and that's why the U.S. Navy is really interested in using them, because they create this incredibly concrete sense of, oh, that's how it works. Because otherwise, it's just 11 years of this resolution that's been hovering in the abstract for everybody that nobody could ever quite make meet the road.
I was going to add that I do think that we did kind of develop a model with Pray the Devil Back to Hell that we found to be really successful. It was interesting when we did the first phase of distribution for us with that was theatrical. And many times, like, grassroots organizations would buy out the theater, but then their members actually wouldn't come to the theater. But then we went to the second phase where they actually brought the film to their members. And it was really different because they could then use the film for building an issue like you're talking about, where people were doing stuff around violence against women, and they, or peace, or whatever the issues were that they decided to use it around. And it was with that we had 400 screenings, and that it was extremely successful. So I think that the idea that if we can get the groups to get the films to the groups, they can figure out how to best use it for their own purposes. Yeah.
Okay, I want to open the floor for people to ask questions or make comments. And I can just barely see you because we're sitting down. I see a hand in the back here. If you would maybe come to the mic so people can hear you and also get recording. And we can, anyone else who'd like to speak after him, you're welcome to either stand behind the mic or come close to it so we can have some dialogue. Thank you. If you would introduce yourselves too, please. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Mark Turner. My question is, using the Arab Revolution that's going on, it wouldn't using the film to negotiate some kind of political dialogue, wouldn't that be kind of counterproductive? I mean, that, to me, that seems to be the problem, is these women don't have a say in these pseudo-political, pseudo-democratic societies in the government. You know, it's kind of like Back to the Future. I mean, using, again, the Arab Revolution as a blueprint, that's what the problem is. They need to begin to understand it. Look, you're not a democratic society. You want to be. You understand the things from democratic, what you look in the media and what on social media and stuff. But you're not United States of America. You're not democratic by any way, stretch of the imagination. You're more neoliberal than anything else, and I won't get into the long jargon, but how you plan to separate the politics, whether you're using the film or not, and not have the discussion thereof of women, again, not being involved in, you know, the political process in these countries. How do you plan to do that?
Well, there every context in every country is different from the next, and the role that women play in particularly the Middle East varies from country to country and even inside of those countries greatly from place to place to place. But generally speaking, they have much more of a role than they've been credited with by our media, and much more of a role than you would know based on, you know, just what you get out of you know, when you watch the news at night. In Egypt, in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen, in Bahrain, in Tunisia, there have been very significant numbers of women that have been absolutely central to those movements that have been once again wiped out and rubbed out and made invisible to us by the way we tend to cover these things. I think this is partly due to the fact that women tend to organize at a collective level, and it's just simply very difficult as a journalist to tell a story like that. We keep looking for a particular person or a specific ego that we can then tell a story about, because that's just the way journalists are set up. And then they come into a room full of women who don't necessarily have a leader and don't necessarily have an author or a story that they can tell that they can hang a hook on, and so they just give up and don't try to tell it. Now, all of these movements have been, once the rubber has met the road and the governments are starting to form, all of them have found themselves gradually being locked out as these governments are formed, particularly as in Egypt it's gotten more authoritarian. So this is their fight. This is their fight. It's not our fight to fight. And we couldn't help them even if we tried. So the deal is, what you do is you go in and you strengthen them. You give them these very teachable skills about organizing, about how to use international law, about how to appeal to governments, how to petition, how to organize a sit-in, a stand-in, a be-in, a love-in, or whatever it is. There are a million teachable skills. And then what you do is you have enough faith in them to know that, you know, they're going to take it to the place of democracy, because what we know from vast experience through history is that when you give women enough power and in critical mass, what they tend to push for is progressive policies toward open democracies, toward transparent governmental systems. This is all, there are plenty of studies to show this, toward less waste, toward less corruption, and toward more money for things like education and housing and schools and water and so forth. So this is about having faith in the thesis, right? And having faith in the women that once we give them the tools that they need, they're going to run with them in the right direction.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's to underscore what Abby said, is that in every single one of these movements in the Mideast, and that women have been very involved, very instrumental from the very beginning. And if it's a story that we don't know, it's because the press isn't reporting on it. And I mean, the one of the first people to call for a gathering in Tahrir Square was a young woman who's now running for office in Egypt. But it's and the same thing happened in Libya. It was just a woman from Yemen who won the Nobel Peace Prize. Women are very active in these movements, and actually, these are just tools for them to show that this is also happening to women all over the world.
And I think I would just add the tools to get recognized when the official processes start, because I think this is what we've seen over and over again.
Right.
Women are active in the pre-war and in the conflict and in peacemaking, but when official peace processes start, nobody can seem to find who the women are.
Yeah.
Can't find them, or you can't name them. I remember a story from Carolyn McCaskey, who was one of the first women special representatives in peacekeeping, and she talks about how she would sit in the room with other UN mediators, and they would not be able to remember the names of the women in the different countries. It just, the women were an undifferentiated mass.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I think this is also part of breaking through. It isn't only that women work collectively, but women still often are seen as a kind of undifferentiated group. Yes, the women were involved, yeah. but naming who they were is a training exercise. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Jennifer McCarthy, and I just want to echo, well, first of all, let me say thank you so much for creating this series, which is such a resource for all of us working in this area. I want to echo what Charlotte said about when young people view this, because I watched the series with my daughter, and even though I've been traveling to conflict countries for years and coming back and telling her what's been happening there, at the end of watching the first section, she said to me, "Mom, how come I didn't know about this?" Like, well, what do you think I've been talking about? But just seeing it visually makes it real in a way that is so powerful and such a learning tool. So I wanted to also talk about how to reach opinion leaders with the series, because I'm working now for a network of parliamentarians from 131 countries. And I think many of them would be receptive to showing some, at least some of the series, maybe the 17-minute clip, in parliaments, in conflict and post-conflict and interested countries. So I'd love to work with you on that.
Great. Is there ever a time that you have that they all meet together?
Yes.
I mean, maybe we could do a screening.
It's possible.
Yeah, and we have the 17-minute clip that you just saw, but we also have a 45-minute, compilation reel, which is a little bit more on each of the stories, and so that's another thing that would be great, and then we could take it from there.
That sounds great.
Do you want to say a little more while we get... Oh, we have another question. I want to come back to hearing a little more about the different ways that it can be used, mm-hmm. that different people can do. But let's take a few questions, and then we'll... Yeah.
What? Go ahead.
Please. Hi. Thank you so much. That was extraordinary. Lorna Solis. I run a nonprofit. I bring girls from refugee camps to Ivy League universities in the U.S., and so I'm in a lot of those conflict regions that were covered in your film. And my question to you is, how do you encourage or welcome in the men to come and watch? Because as you look at the representation in this room, I'm sure this is kind of a commonality, probably where you're showing the film. I hope I'm wrong, but I just know from my experience when I'm in a camp and I'm speaking about specific gender-related issues, the room's full of women. And I have to kind of, I've learned throughout the years to understand how to, talk about this so that men can come with that. So I kind of, it's kind of like the broccoli in the soup, but you have to put it in the blender first. I do that now. And then men show up and they're enlightened by it at the end and they come say thank you. But if I just say women, this, so how do you find that? How do you go around it and make sure that the men hear this as well so it impacts them as well? And it's great that you have this on TV and you know, because then you get to a mass audience that way. So thank you.
You know, I mean, for one thing, you're so right, and that's why the schools are so important, and we're really putting a big emphasis on getting the films into the schools. A lot of schools have discovered us, and it's required viewing, and that's for classes with men and women, and actually when we looked for interns for the series, more men applied than women, so young men are really interested in this subject, and they're getting it in the schools. We've created wonderful curriculum. We're going from the high school to the college, you know, level, so that's one, I think, really, and real key.
Do you know, I know that they did a breakdown, but what they think the gender breakdown on the viewers were, do you remember what that was? No?
Was there?
I thought so.
It was, actually.
It was like 60-40?
It's the PB. That's also the PBS audience. Is more women, yeah.
But I have to say that I think for Pray the Devil Back to Hell, I would say that we have not. I don't think the audiences have been predominantly women. But again, I think that specific question. I mean, I think that it's also how will the, you know, when we're talking about doing outreach, I think what we feel is like, at least I certainly feel this way. I'm actually a filmmaker, and what we did is to make tools for other people to use for the work that they do. And I don't know how they're going to do that, but you know, I think.
Yeah, and it's a different depending on what what audience we're talking about, right?
That was what I was seeing.
Right.
I meant when you go abroad.
Exactly. But you know, so when I go into conflict zones and post-conflict zones, it is mostly women who show up, and I have to. Believe that In fact, the places where the men don't show up, it probably is important for the women to really get together and organize without them anyway, because that's how unequal the statuses are. And so it probably benefits the women not to have men in the space, because there is such an enormous amount of distrust and a history of violence and problems. But when you are talking to policymakers and the influencers and the big muckety mucks, that's another thing entirely, because men do not show up. If it has something to do with women, and if a man is a big deal, he doesn't show up. And this is particularly true of men in the developed world and over, say, like 40 years old. It's really hard to get them there. Once you have them there, they're really glad they came. So my feeling is you go through trusted emissaries. You find people who will speak for you that they value and trust, particularly men. That's why we got Matt Damon to do the voice in one of the hours. And we try to kind of get male evangelists speaking for us as much as possible. It's a way of saying, you know, the water's really fine. You know, nobody's going to hurt you, and we won't scare you away. It's really all right. You can come. But nevertheless, it does occasionally raise the hackles, because it does feel like, when you're talking about women in conflict, it does feel to some men that you're talking about men are bad and women are good, and that men are always going to fight and women are always going to be peaceful, which is in no way what we're espousing in this, but it does tend to trigger a really interesting discussion. So it's always worth it to get them there, but I think it really, the only way to do that is to get other men to advocate for you with them.
Hi. Well, thank you very much. I had seen The Devil Pray the Devil Back to Hell in Boston over a year ago, and then subsequently I watched all the others. I'm a television producer, and I'm trained in conflict resolution and actually working on a very big project in Cambridge, and I'd love to maybe do other screenings or talk to you. But if you don't mind, I want to ask a question that kind of goes back, not what we do with this, where I understand very well what it can do, especially Abigail, with, you know, cigar-filled rooms. Those are the people sometimes you want to reach, right?
Yes,
but
exactly.
Then those are the same people who are holding the purse strings sometimes during and after and before and later in the conflict. So I want to ask, how did you deal with that during the producing of it? Because I think, to me as a documentarian, that's a very key. I mean, how did you deal with it? Did you have resistance? What was the balance?
Yeah.
That's my
yeah.
question.
You know, it's interesting. I think in general for women in the media, it's not so much this resistance. You don't get men standing up saying, I don't want women to do any of these things, and it's really stupid. They don't have to do that. All they have to do is sit on their hands or support you with tepid support, you know, because that's just enough to either doom you or just send you off to some little ghetto of poor production values and no viewers. So I actually kind of knew we'd get lukewarm support from a lot of places. And I figured we'd get them, but they'd give us less than they would have given Ken Burns. You know, that's just the way it is. I knew I'd been working in raising money for women's organizations long enough that I wasn't even going to rely on the usual suspects, because I knew that that was what would happen. We'd get that tepid, dooming you to the girl ghetto thing. So right from the get-go, we went to individuals because they're much more flexible. It's easier to make a case with them. There's a constituency of people who really do support women in media. And so we made a decision to go for 40 individuals who could give us $50,000 apiece out of our $4.5 million budget. And I just thought, I just don't want to have to count on, you know, the really big checks from the really big foundations. They're not going to happen. And that's exactly how it played out. So we got nice checks from big foundations. We got a beautiful check from OSI. And then we got a lot of individuals. So I'm actually very proud to say that our funding pod was so long we had to actually take a couple seconds out of the films, because they've never had a series funded by this many entities before. And I also sort of believe that helped us with audience development, because we had a whole lot of people with literally skin in the game who wanted to see this succeed. So I just thought, we're not going to do this unless we think of it in a different way. And I'm really glad that we got out there and really shook the trees and found a lot of different funders. But I think that's the only way to do it, because the people who hold the purse strings and they don't buy the thesis.
And I also have to say, to Steven Sigaler's credit, who is head of programming, news and public affairs at WNET, he immediately, Pam, you should tell the story, because you brought the film, you brought the idea to him.
Yeah, and he just immediately said that that's brilliant, you know, we're in. We'll license Pray the Devil, you know, work with Abby and Ginny to create the American version, and we'll be the lead station, you know, with really no idea, you know, where that money would come from. So we have promoted him from a person of gender to an official girl.
You know, and that without that support, I mean, it's not, with anybody, foundations or anybody's going to be more interested, or individuals are more interested in giving you money if you're sure that you're going to be on the air. And so we had that first. And then Miriam came, it was the first money in OSI. I mean, it was just incredible what that meant for us.
We wouldn't be sitting here today without OSI. Totally not.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this series. It was awesome, absolutely awesome. My name is Marcia Fingal, and I make documentaries on social justice issues, so this is really fantastic for me. My question is, could you speak a little bit about the challenges you encountered in some of the countries where you were filming, just the uniqueness of it, because it's not like you're on a Hollywood set. So how did you craft some of those stories and shoot and that sort of thing? Thanks.
Well, I mean, Afghanistan, well, you know, there was five different films, and so they had five different kind of stories. Pray the Devil, Back to Hell, two of the films, actually, both Bosnia and Pray the Devil, Back to Hell, were historical films, and so we relied on archival footage. And Pam, I'll let her tell the story of I Came to Testify about Bosnia, because that had a very huge set of problems. With the film in Afghanistan, we decided to film there as the story was unfolding, so we decided to film over a period of 6 months. So we chose to work with a team that was already living in Kabul so that they could continue to follow the story. They were in Kabul. Filming in Kandahar was incredibly dangerous, and so we actually hired somebody else who had been used to filming there. She went in. She had to live with Shahida, the woman in Kandahar, for a few days in order to be able to shoot. She had to wear a burqa. We kind of rigged a burqa cam that she could wear under the burqa for when she went out on the street. We also had somebody else that was embedded with the military for a while. I mean, that was a very long shoot and gathered footage for a long time to create that. And I Pray the Devil, Back to Hell, as I said, it was historical, so a lot of the war footage is all archival footage, and then we did the interviews with the women. One of the hardest things about that film was actually finding footage of the women. So many people say, oh, the footage and the war footage, how'd you get that? It's incredible footage. In fact, that was really easy to get, and I think that I looked at like 3 to 4 weeks full time in the edit room, 10 hours a day of war footage. And it was a very depressing month of my life. But I think that almost every single frame of the footage that we found of the women is in the film, which is just to tell you the kind of relationship of what there is. These stories are not being told. Colombia, I think we shot, I mean, like for several different stories before we landed on the right story. So why don't you take it from there?
Yeah. I mean, Colombia, the women in the community were under death threats, but they've decided as a strategy, a very sophisticated strategy, that they're, by aligning themselves with the international community, with journalists, with filmmakers, that does actually make them a little bit safer. So that even though their names are on death threats, they're a little less likely to be singled out. So they made a choice to work with our filmmaker, Oriana Zill, and allow her to film them as they defended their community against eviction and stood up to these death threats. And then Bosnia was a subtle and a powerful conflict. Our DP, Kirsten Johnson, who shot in every war zone in the world, said it was the most frightening and upsetting shoot she's ever been on, because it's really a frozen conflict there. And we were telling the story of Muslim women, and we were going to Republika Srpska, where they had been attacked, which is now completely, you know, controlled by ethnic Serbs, and don't want the Muslims back, and there are no monuments to what happened to the women there, and there's great hostility to reporters coming in. And we were shooting, you know, We were shooting, you know, at the tennis hall where many of the rapes took place. It's not like Dachau, you know, where it's now a place where people go and learn the history. It's where kids are playing ping pong and tennis, and and they chase you away if you're filming it, and they know that you're filming it because of what used to happen there. So we worked with amazing Bosnian journalists who felt the story was important and helped protect us, and we tried to also protect them. Of course, it was also really, really difficult starting the conversation with women who don't want to talk about it, and they're tired of the journalists, and they're tired of telling their story to someone who goes and makes a career out of it, and then they're there and they're living in poverty, and they're physically sick, and sometimes have psychological problems that really last a whole lifetime, and the trauma, it'll go away, and then little things will remind them, it'll come back. And telling your story can make that happen. And so, again, it was just a long process of talking with women who had survived this, and then really finding a trust and women coming forward and saying, we want to be part of this. They liked the idea of being part of a project which had stories of other women in other countries and feeling like part of something bigger. And actually, quite a few witnesses wanted to talk with us who ultimately were not allowed to speak with us. Some of the very young women, they were 12 sometimes, these girls who were being held in the rape camps, 12-year-old girls. And, so now they're, 27, 30, gone on with their lives, having babies, gotten married, living in different countries oftentimes. They heard about the project through sources I can't even tell you because no one's supposed to talk with the witnesses and no one's supposed to be on Facebook with them, but everyone is. And because none of them have their names known, and they all accepted this protection, but then ultimately, really, there were a lot of issues with the courts. In one case, Scotland Yard came to the woman's house and said, "You can't participate, or we'll have to take away the protection." So we were, there were all those kinds of issues, and just the constant tension of knowing, as we were filming in Foča, the mayor of Foča now, which is where our story focuses on what happened in this one particular town, is a microcosm of what happened in the country. The mayor is the only voice of unity in the region, and he did welcome us in and say, come around with me. And we have a feature online about him and what he's trying to do in Foča. But, he's hated by a lot of people, and when we were filming one of his meetings, one of his enemies shut the whole thing down, and, so it was very tense, but
Not to say the least that you couldn't film any of the women's faces. And so Pam made a film about characters who you couldn't see their faces, and so I had to find ways around dealing with that too.
Yeah,
and distorting their voices, and yet you don't, I think, don't really feel that you feel like you're connecting with them, and so I think
it was a filming challenge.
There were a lot of challenges.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Anna. Thank you very much, and thank you for your 48 appearances in 1 month. It's inspiring. I actually have two questions. The first one is, you've made a lot of references to media and how media plays a role in the fact that women aren't really covered. I wonder if you encountered a lot of women in media in the countries that you were working in, and whether or not they played a role in the film that you made, or the films that you made. And the second question is regarding generational differences, and if you encountered any generational differences that you could talk about.
Very few women in any of the media in any of these countries we covered. They're all highly patriarchal societies, and there are women. There are really important women. Juanita León is one. It depends. It varies from country to country. But I think for the most part, the persistent lack of these stories and the persistent lack of stories specifically from the perspective we're telling them, like within the confines of what a woman knows and when she knows it, are just almost completely unknown and undone. And that's just the way it kind of is. And so we're sort of asserting a way of thinking about this that's incredibly unusual. And when we did encounter women, they were, enthused about working with us, to say the least, because for that, they totally got it about what we were trying to do. What was the second half of that question?
Generation.
Oh, yeah, that's actually really interesting. I think, again, it depends on from country to country what you're talking about. Bosnia is, there is such a difference in the generations in how they understand what happened and what needs to happen. And of course, it really depends on where you are. Sarajevo is one kind of place, and then just drive a little east of there and you'll find something like parallel universe, the likes of which you won't soon forget. So it depends on where you are. I will say one of the best screenings we had for Pray the Devil Back to Hell was in Khartoum, because nobody knows that there's a 100-year-old women's university in Khartoum, like a Wellesley kind of place, where you can get a BA in peace studies. And half the women there are there on full scholarship, and they're from the conflict zones, which is really interesting. So, you know, we did a screening for women who were maybe 20 years old, who were from all over the conflict zones and inside of Khartoum. And what was clear in the discussion after that was they were really looking for a fresh way to think about these conflicts, because they were really tired of the way their parents' generation had conducted themselves. And I think, generally speaking, in conflict zones, that's very much the case, especially where there's a hardened conflict or a persistent conflict. You'll find that young people really are trying to figure out another way through.
And also, I think for me that when we're talking about the when I've been talking about the media, I'm really talking about the way I'm mostly talking about the U.S. media and the way that that war is conveyed here, in both the Colombian film and in the Liberian film. Two of the main characters in the film, one was a radio journalist in the Liberian film, and Juanita León in the Colombian film was a print journalist. So I mean, and also just talking about that women's perspective on war is not normally shown. So taking, except as victims or collateral damage, but to actually say, what is the perspective, and they are the main actors, and to tell the story from that perspective. I mean, we did have U.S. journalists tell us that they were in Liberia and they saw the women, the stories about women sitting on, one of the main things that they did was to sit on this airfield every single day, and it was a main thoroughfare through town, so you couldn't avoid them. And they sat in that field to protest, whether it was raining or whether it was sun, whatever. And they said, oh, yeah, we saw those women. They were so pathetic looking that we didn't bother to film them. And then they were key players in ending the war. But because seeing a 9-year-old boy with a gun is so much more, in some ways, a seductive image, and it kind of plays into stereotypes, it's more alarming, it's more threatening. So there was, in the hotel that we stayed in, that we actually had stayed around during the whole war, there was like jokes by local cartoonists about all the foreign journalists who would come and take pictures of these boy soldiers, and who sometimes I felt like, especially after some of the footage that I saw, it was unclear to me whether some of those journalists, I'm not saying that they were provoking that activity, but whether some of the performances start to go on for the journalist. And I think that's kind of what I've been talking about.
Hi, my name's Kim Pate. I'm visiting from Canada. I just happened to be here and so was happy to be able to come in person instead of having to watch it online. Thank you very much for the series. We're in a situation now. The organization I head is called the Elizabeth Fry Society. It's a national organization. It works with marginalized, victimized, criminalized, and institutionalized women and girls. And I also teach part-time at the Faculty of Law at the University of Ottawa. And the courses we're teaching are Defending Battered Women on Trial and talk about the war on women that we're experiencing that you're experiencing here and we're experiencing in Canada. And one of the things I would ask for the discussion guide, if you haven't already put it in yourselves, is to think about ways to encourage women in countries where we think we've already got equality. Legally in Canada, we have one of the best constitutional we have the best constitutional equality that you can have in terms of the law, but we're in especially right now, we happen to be in a regime where we're likely to see most of those protections, they've already been eviscerated, and women are the fastest growing prison population as a result, and the fastest growing number on the street, and on and on. And so something that draws the parallel so the discussion can come about what happens when you don't protect the freedoms, mm-hmm. the human rights, the rule of law in your own country, and how that can erode the very freedoms that you've had to be able to put this series together, coming from outside into current conflict zones. So, I'd be very interested if you have any connections in Canada. We'd be very interested in linking up because we have a Feminist Alliance for International Action that we're part of that. Great. We would very much like to see some
Great.
Discussion.
Great, thank you for that. Yeah. And Angie Wang is sitting over there. She's the girl. Anybody who has any thoughts on outreach should talk to Angie Wang, who's my outreach queen. We haven't found a better title for her. But I will say that in developed world audiences, I find that the most fruitful way to talk about violence in our own societies around women is to address masculinity. And I've shown all these films now in front of audiences that are very half-half women, men, but I've also shown Pray the Devil Back to Hell in all boys' schools several different times. And there is always a really interesting conversation about masculinity, in part because they'll say to you, especially the high school kids, they'll say, where are the good men? Why are there no good men in this film? You know, you edited them all out. That wasn't fair. And I'm like, well, actually, you know, there's a guy carrying his grandma, and there are people bringing out the dead and burying them, and there's that great mediator at the conference. The question is, maybe, why aren't there good men? There are good men. Why didn't you see them? You know, what was it about those men that made you kind of look past them to the 9-year-old with the gun and the other guy and so forth? So what is it we're asking of men in terms of crafting a life of meaning and significance that makes a man like that sort of disappear in your estimation? And that always ends up being a really interesting discussion. And I always find, like, then once you get there, you can back off, and then it becomes this really, really powerful dialogue. So I'm hoping that, especially by targeting schools, we will trigger lots of discussion about masculinity that may, in fact, really be radicalizing.
Lisa. Hi, I'm Lisa Jackson, proud to be one of your fellow documentarians. I love this series. It has potential to be a game changer, a world changer. I got so invested in the stories that I was listening to. And in two of the stories, there was a very stated threat. You know, the threat was stated, the risk was stated, and the others, it was implied. So I'm very curious to know if you've shown the film in Sarajevo, in Kandahar, in La Toma, and the effect that it's had locally to the women who gave so much of their stories to y'all.
Absolutely. I mean, it's always been part of the plan, because Lisa is a really wonderful filmmaker, you need to know, and made The Greatest Silence and this. What was the film called about the sex crimes unit? Sex Crime Unit.
Good title.
Which, last I checked, was still on demand on HBO. Beautiful films, both of them. You know, you don't want to go to a place and interview people and then never go back again. It's really hideous. And there's something horrible about documentaries where the people who give you their lives then don't get rewarded for that, and you just feel awful. So we really do want to take the films back in a way that's very aware and sensitive to and respectful of the limitations, which are going to be different in every place. I mean, I do think that the women's increasing visibility in Colombia helps them, but in Afghanistan, it hurts them. So there's a different approach for every country. There's some question with Shahida Hussein about whether or not she wants her face to be seen. Probably not in Afghanistan.
I don't think we're not going to be showing this film in Kandahar. I think that that's a no. But we have shown it already to the women in Kabul. Yeah. And to the women who participated.
Right. I mean, generally, what we're going to do, Lisa, is show it there with their permission and as they feel that it's helpful, because they're the ones who put themselves on the line. And for example, in Bosnia is one little village. Everybody knows everybody. And one of the two women survivors who participated in our film is under death threats because her rapist is walking the streets. And so we're in the process right now of showing both of them the film and hopefully getting their blessing to show it in Bosnia, because there are a lot of groups, and it's been seen by so much of the diaspora. There's 1 million Bosnians who have fled the country, and it's sort of becoming well known among them, and there's a clamor to show that in Bosnia. We very much hope to, but we need them to feel comfortable. Same with the two women in Colombia. They're coming here in January, so we're going to have events with them here, and then see how they feel about having it there, because they won a court victory after we filmed, and then that almost backfired and made them more at risk. So, because they're sitting on very valuable land, you know, millions and millions of dollars worth of gold. So we have to see what they want to do.
You know, it probably won't be on the WNET website, but if you come to Pieces Loud or PrayTheDevilBackToHell.com, I think once we get our shit together. it's been a long year. We will hopefully be updating there. On the Facebook page.
Yeah. Actually, we'll take this last question, then I want to give you a chance to say sort of what are the follow-up things that people can connect to, great. Like that. And also just to pick up on the point that Pamela just made, I think all women activists and human rights defenders, as we would call them, are in that calculation constantly about at what point do you become more public as a way to protect yourself?
Yeah.
And in fact, I would say that the one of the progresses women have made is to see that actually being more public is usually greater protection, even if you may have some backlash. And this has been a big issue for the women's movement, where we have been confronted with people saying, but actually you've created more danger for those women. And I think that we have to acknowledge that sometimes in the short run there is more danger, there is backlash. But that's part of the process of change. So it's really, it's up to the women to decide when they're ready to do that. But if you look at the movement as a whole, there's been a big step toward, we understand that we actually have to face the backlash. And the exposure is greater protection than staying quiet, which women have done for centuries and hasn't really protected us. So I think we're in that moment with these films.
There were seven women last year in Ivory Coast who were shot wearing white T-shirts and protesting peacefully during the election violence after Gbagbo's loss there. And I know that the film has been shown really broadly in Ivory Coast. I know they were influenced by it. I don't know how much the administration was aware of it, but I know that Mrs. Gbagbo had seen the film. So, you know, I definitely had a bad dark night of the soul or two over whether or not we'd had something to do with that. And it is true that we are playing with fire here, and there will be danger. There's no question. This is a dangerous game.
I think the bigger issue for another discussion is how overall we work with human rights groups and others to protect the women who are under greater attack. And in across the world, there is actually much more attack on women as activists today than there was 20 years ago, precisely because women are pushing these boundaries. Yeah. And there are more women who have been killed specifically for their activism. And so this is a game that we have to continue to see how to build greater protection for them. But it's the films themselves are only one part of that whole thing, because what women are seeing is that speaking out actually is going to protect you overall, even if it may not in that moment. So please,
Suki Tirada Ports. Yes, there is some danger, but on the other hand, I'm not sure as I would have thought that we would see three women winning the Peace Prize, and that only came about specifically one I know because of the filming that you did, and because of the film being there and other people seeing it and saying this has got to be recognized. But quite apart, so thank you for all of that. But quite apart from that, one of the first things that I heard in my life was my parents discussing the Hiroshima maidens that were brought to this country to have their faces repaired from the nuclear attack by the U.S., which is the only one that has weapons of mass destruction and has used it. Mm-hmm. However, I weep for us, for the U.S., because at the same time that we're looking at what's going on in other countries, we're going to come up with an incredible election in the next year. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how many people are going to be willing to speak up and really sign up and say, we didn't learn to lift teacups, and I think we have to look at teacups in a different way. It's not the finger anymore. It's a different finger that's being poked at many of us. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to really be very wary of feeling too much satisfaction that we're living in a democracy, so that I think what the woman from Canada mentioned, I would love to see some part of your study plan that you show in schools in the U.S. pointing out the need for our youngsters to begin to analyze what's in their paper and to look at editorials and look at what's on the front page of the New York Times, which should be on the editorial page and not reported as if it was reporting. Mm-hmm. And I think that we really need to look at what's going on here. And so I thank you for what you're doing, because it's making a lot of people think, but I hope they also think about the parallel of what's going on here.
Yeah, it's certainly like, it's been very much in my heart, especially going around the country and talking about these films to American audiences. And you would never know that we were actually in war. You would never know that this is a country at war. You just, you know, unless you pick up the newspaper and read it, you never feel it where you go around this country. And that is so extraordinary. And, you know, to hear Condoleezza Rice say, yeah, they're not really collateral damage anymore, like we used to think of them, like as though that was okay when we called them collateral damage, that was somehow all right. So, I mean, part of what I want to do is by not going directly at combat the way we conduct it as Americans, but by instead elliptically raising a lot of questions about the way we talk about war in this country, I hope to kind of trigger some more critical thinking about war without also triggering all the defensive thinking and the distancing that occurs when people seem to be taking a political stand about Iraq or Afghanistan and so forth. I think that if we talk about war in general, maybe we have a little bit better sense as voters of what it is that we do or don't want to reward at the ballot box. If we have a better sense of, for instance, the next time our leader wants to use the words shock and awe to describe something, what actually is happening on the ground when we say that. You know, I just feel like if we really had a full appreciation of that, we might behave a little differently as voters.
And I just also want to say that for the Canadian woman who brought, I'd love to put this into our material about the war on women here, too. I think the CDC released a report yesterday that they did a survey with 9 million women. 1 million had been raped in the last year, and that 1 out of 5 women had been raped. I mean, that's 10% of the women in the last year alone, that's, like, really shocking. And I do think it is a kind of thing that people don't talk about or don't really realize is going on.
Okay, we'll take one more. Oh, yeah. This one is the last one.
Okay, it'll be quick. My name is Elizabeth Herman, and I'm a photographer and researcher, and I'm doing a project on women in conflict as well. And I was just wondering, I spent the last year in Bangladesh, and a lot of the women that I spoke to in Bangladesh spoke about the national history and memory of the war and how they're written out of it. And how there's a desire to rewrite the history. And so a lot of this became not only about their experiences at the time, but also the way their lives have changed since the war and, you know, the recognition that the men have received and the women did the same things and they got nothing. And I was wondering if in any of the places that you went, women spoke to a desire to rewrite the history, if any of the women are going to use what you made to help rewrite history, perhaps, mm-hmm. and if you're going to schools with that.
You know, it's funny, the first time certainly rewriting history was a very conscious, deliberate piece of the motivation around making Pray the Devil Back to Hell. And I remember when I picked up The Economist magazine and they refer offhandedly without mentioning the film about the women in Liberia, I thought, yes, you know, right at the heart of patriarchy, we did it. And that felt really good. But it's interesting that when we showed it for the first time, even before it was done, we showed it to these women, and they said to me, I never realized what we did was so important. They didn't think of it as history, and that's a big piece of why we don't get into the history, is partly we don't assert ourselves in that way nearly enough, and so we need to also trigger some of that demanding of the attention, as well as just not waiting for it to rain down on us. When in Sarajevo, I showed the film in Sarajevo a few months ago, and we talked back and forth about whether or not we gave too much credit to the International Criminal Tribunal, and there's definitely in Bosnia a lot of a sense that they really didn't do a very good job, depending on who you talk to. So we had that conversation around, and finally I said, you know, you guys, that those convictions were incredibly important setting of precedent, and that basically there have been a whole bunch of prosecutions based on your convictions and the precedent they set. And you know that rape will now be prosecuted in a way it never was before. You changed history. And I just was so amazed that the women in the room were looking at me like, no, we never thought of that before. And that was kind of interesting. So I think, I don't think there, it depends, again, depending on what place and what women and so forth. Women are different everywhere. But for the most part, there's that's kind of a tendency we have to kind of do something and then get back to the dishes or whatever without really demanding that we be recorded.
But I would add, though, that we've been showing the Bosnia film in communities where there are a lot of Bosnians, like here in New York and St. Louis, which has the most, the biggest Bosnian diaspora in the country. And Bosnians are saying thank you for putting the history into a film, because it's one thing that the court says that this happened. It's another thing that a historian writes it. But to have you know, a film, because what's happening in Bosnia now is politicians are saying it didn't happen, or the rapes never happened, or it was, you know, the Bosniaks were the aggressors, and history's being, you know, kind of rewritten as it always is. And so this is, you know, people are very happy that this is, you know, a film testimony.
Yeah, and I just want to say that when Lema Bowie accepted her Nobel Peace Prize, she ended her speech saying that Liberia had used to be a country that was known for child soldiers, but it would now be a country that was known for its white T-shirt women. And boy, did that make my day.
She started to cry right there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I want to add to that. I think that women are rewriting the history everywhere. Yeah. I mean, and the problem has been, and I think that's where the film is such an important tool, is getting that to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I know just what you were saying in Bangladesh. I know several articles and things that women have written about, and books about the war in between Pakistan and Bangladesh and what happened to women. But getting that information from those alternative bookstores or academic pieces into the mainstream interpretation of what happened is where I think these films are so powerful. Yeah. And I'm just, as a final kind of reminiscence, when you're mentioning the Nobel Prize, and I remember the project, 1,000 Women for the Nobel Prize, which was about 5 or 8 years ago, and a group nominated 1,000 women peacemakers for the Nobel Prize, and the Nobel Prize Committee basically paid no attention to them whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And now, 8 years later, in part because of what the film makes visible, that all that work that was done by those 1,000 women, you know, becomes visible. And the film helps to lift that up. So I think that's the kind of recovery of history that the film isn't just creating. It's that is out there. The film is making it visible at another level, which will hopefully help all of those other pieces to become visible.
What has to happen is partly, you know, there has to be lots of this kind of media, because it, you know, one project gets offloaded into the sidelines again. But project after project after project, those can't be ignored, and eventually we penetrate the mainstream. But it takes a lot of work and a lot of faith and a lot of money and a lot of people just constantly pushing on this idea. We will never get. We would never have gotten anywhere with the Nobel Committee if we hadn't been a complete pain in their necks. So Norway has really come around. Norway has really come around. So I think that that's a sign of how far that you can travel. And I remember my favorite screening was in Kinshasa in Congo, where you know, it's a 72-minute film, and it was at the university, and it was stupidly at night. You don't do things at night if you want women to come in a country like Congo, because women, you know, can't go out at night. And so we stupidly, but it turned out to be a great thing, because we had like 40 men, only men. And four of them came up to us afterwards, and each independent of the others, and said, you know, I never really thought women could do much of anything, but I think I'm thinking of it differently right now. You know, people can be moved in a very relatively short period of time. These things are much more flexible than we give them credit for being, and we just need to be relentless.
So one final word on how people can get the information on the film, the DVDs, distribution,
WomenWarAndPeace.org. WomenWarAndPeace.org is our fantastic, terrific website. And while it will not continue to be updated unless somebody wants to give us money to do that, we'd be glad to do that. You can buy DVD box sets off of that website, and you can stream all the films live off that website in the United States. So that is the easiest way to get them. The full-length version of Pray the Devil Back to Hell, because we cut it back to 52 minutes, and that was like taking out our own appendix with our bare hands. The 72-minute version is available at praythedevilbacktohell.com. And then in terms of the screening series in a box kit, talk to Angie now, and if you want to direct anybody there ever, you contact us either through the Facebook page, Women, War, and Peace, or at peaceisloud.org. So there are a million ways to do it. Did I say womenwarandpeace.com? I meant .org. Okay. So lots of ways, and please spread the word. Help us spread the word. We want these out broadly.
Great. Thank you. Any last word, Jenny, Pamela?
All right.
Thank you all. Thank you, Miriam. And there's food. There's food and wine and drinks to sit and chat.